Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Stephen Hope. I did this interview originally when he was performing in Das Barbecue at Florida Studio Theater, but didn't get a chance to play it until now. Now, he's choreographing the adorable 50s explosion of music called Let's Twist Again for the Wanderers at Florida Studio Theater's Cabaret Performance Space. Stephen is an exuberant personality, both on stage and in this interview. And you will hear me talk at the beginning of the interview about how much impact he has as a performer. It's a very interesting story, and he is a very delightful guy. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Living the life you were meant to live. About recognizing, first and foremost, that you may be one of the many of us who were forced to hide, to dissemble, to bury, to pretend, to deny a part of yourself in order to survive your childhood. This doesn't only happen because there's abuse or neglect or trauma. This can happen in the most benign situations. You have a parent who was brought up to be very proper, and you're a rambunctious child, and your parent doesn't have the skills to deal with a rambunctious child, or maybe even actually probably when your parent was a rambunctious child, some parent let him or her know that that was not okay. And so your rambunctiousness triggers a memory inside of your parent of when they were shut down, and it's too painful. So with the best of intentions, a kind and loving parent can suppress a natural tendency in a child without understanding that that quality, whatever it is, even rambunctiousness, is necessary to the full expression of who that person is, and that that person cannot live the life that was meant for them, cannot be in sync with themselves, cannot feel whole without that peace. Now, rambunctiousness may not sound to you, especially if you come from a family that says no, no, no to that. It may not sound to you like an important quality. But I promise you that as a therapist, I see lots of people, lots of clients come to me because they cannot express themselves, because they get tongue-tied, because they get shy, because they get embarrassed. And so they keep so much of who they are, what I call undercover, hidden. And that means that not only are they not demonstrating, expressing who they really are, you might not think that's that important, but they're always feeling sort of at odds with themselves, sort of like a failure, sort of like a fraud. And that's not a good way to live. So, as I do in my practice, it is my hope, my intention, my purpose to say to you, if you're feeling any of that stuff, if you're feeling out of sync with yourself, as though there is a way you would want to be, dream of being, wish you could be, but find yourself stuck, that quality may already be part of your repertoire, and it is not impossible to recover. I talk about that in the show. I talk about that in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. I also try and make this point by interviewing people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because it's so difficult for artists to survive in our culture that in order to do it, it has to be who you really are. It has to be the life you were meant to live, and you can do no other. And as I say every week, when you listen to these people, you can hear what it sounds like to be living the life you were meant to live. And today's interview with Stephen Hope is no exception. In fact, he's proving the rule. Stephen comes from a family, luckily for him, which had music, singing, playing all the time. And he was, again, one of the lucky ones whose family allowed him to be who he is. And you can hear it. You can hear it in every word he says. You can also hear at the beginning of the interview, as I said in the run-up, that I saw him and interviewed him at the time when he was in Das Barbecue as a not only a singer and an actor and a dancer and a musician, but also a choreographer in that show. I didn't get to run the interview at that time, but I am running it now as a promotion for Stephen the Choreographer. And you will hear us. Oh, maybe you won't hear us. Of course, you won't hear us because we didn't talk about that then because I didn't know then. But I'm telling you now that he put together some delightful choreography to accompany the current cabaret production at Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. That is Let's Twist Again, The Wanderers, an homage to 50s music. And I want to tell you that I saw it, and if you know and remember 50s music, well, then you must run down. But even if you don't, this is just such a delightful production. So you want to run right down. It's playing until January, as I said, at Florida Studio Theater. But I want you to hear Stephen's interview because it ought to inspire you to try and find yourself. So here, Stephen Hope. So I am here with Stephen Hope in the men's dressing room at FST because we can't find another place that's quiet. And Stephen is here, and he just told me, which I didn't know, that this is his 10th year working at FST.
Yes, I've done well over 20 productions in the past 10 years. I've done at least one show per season since 2002.
Wow. And so this year he is part of the ensemble of Das Barbecue. Yes, right. And also Stephen told me that he went to my website and he listened to a show, which almost nobody thinks to do, by the way. And so he knows that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And that is really why I wanted to interview you, because I saw you, I saw Das Barbecue, and you are clearly an accomplished actor, singer, musician, and then I found out that you choreographed the show.
Yeah, there were three numbers in the show, two full numbers that I set, and then one little dance sequence.
Yeah. So lots of arts, really, and I mean, it's not clear to me whether you guys can see the audience from the stage.
Some of the audience.
Yes.
And it also depends on how much light is falling off the stage into the house. I can, at times, see two-thirds of the way up.
Oh, okay, good. On the opening act, where you're describing the ring cycle, which is hilarious, by the way, I was sitting on the side of the stage, in the audience on the side of the stage where you were standing. And I really did have the sense that you were singing to me. And I knew at the time that there was very little chance that you could actually see me. And I thought that it was a real skill, what you were doing. It really did seem as though you were connected to me and to the audience. I thought that was really wonderful.
Thank you. The audience is never just a big black space out there. And you know that there are individuals out there. And sometimes you can see just an outline or something like that. But that's what theater does, is it speaks to the individual in the audience.
When it's...
When there are 200... 500, 1,500 people.
No, what I meant was when the piece is, not all theater does that.
No,
but ideally, ideally that's what theater does.
This piece breaks the fourth wall, meaning that the audience is another character in the piece. There are plays that do not break the fourth wall, so as an audience member, we're sitting back observing a reality on stage, and we are not part of it. This piece, probably 50% of theater does that. But Shakespeare did that all the time. Mm-hmm. He broke that wall and spoke directly to the audience. That's what makes theater unique, is that the audience is part of the performance.
And so I felt part of the performance.
Well, good. I'm glad you did.
Well, yeah. So now, if you were listening, you know that I only have really one question. And that is, how did it start for you, this love affair with the theater, is what I'm assuming it is, because all of these skills are theater-based.
Hmm? How did it start? It's really hard for me to pinpoint that exact moment. I come from a large, extended southern family, and everybody played an instrument, and we always sang, and I came from a family that had everything from the Beatles to Mahalia Jackson to Beethoven and Barbara Streisand. All of these things were being played at all times. Country Western is part of my heritage. Mm-hmm. So performing there's so many varying degrees of performance. There's performing when you're performing with your family, when you're sitting around the piano and singing. And then there is performing when you're performing for a larger group of people, mostly strangers. That moment probably happened for me in junior high school. I traveled a lot as a kid. Now let me think if I can come up with this again. So I had two schools in Macon, and then two schools in Gainesville, and then there was St. Louis. Oh, three schools in Gainesville. And then there was St. Louis. That was 2 years there, and then 3 years in Louisville before I left. So I was in a lot of different places. My father got his degree at the University of Florida. So he got his undergrad work was done at Mercer University in Macon, and then graduate work in Gainesville, and then postdoctoral work in St. Louis.
Oh, my God.
And then his first position was with the Lion's Eye Institute in Louisville, which is where I did my sophomore through senior year of high school.
So while this was going on, they were having children?
I'm it.
Oh, yeah, they were having child.
I was more than enough. I'm quite the handful.
When you said you had all this extended family, I thought that meant siblings, but it doesn't.
No, I came like on the tail end of my mother's siblings. So I was never really just the nephew. I was kind of like the littlest brother.
Brother, yeah.
So it was awful hard to get.
You're the baby in an extended family and the only child in your parents' family.
In my parents' family.
Oh, nothing like being the little prince.
No. Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no, little prince.
Like I said, I was at the tail end of my mother's siblings.
I see.
So it was, I was very fortunate growing up. With spending as much time with my grandparents as I did, and my mother's parents were both alive. My grandmother is still alive. My father's mother was alive. They were just all extraordinary. And my aunts and uncles, who I adore. And I was the first grandchild and the first nephew. So yeah, I was doted on when I was a baby. But after that, you couldn't get into trouble. There were just way too many eyes on
me. I see. So it was kind of a mixed blessing. I mean, on the one hand, you were a favorite child.
Yeah. For a few years, yes.
Four? Eight?
Eight, maybe.
Eight? That's all it takes.
And then the next, and then I did have
then someone else had a baby?
Well, I had a cousin who we were separated from because of divorce for years. And then the next grandchild was a daughter.
Aye, aye. I see.
So
much younger than you is she?
Eight, 9 years.
Okay, but you had 8 years.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you do have this extended, this very loving, very theatrical family.
My grandfather was a minister, so yes, there is theater involved in the ministry.
Yes, there is.
Standing up in front of a group of people,
trying to
sway
them
four times a week.
Hello, trying to
or comfort them or just
impact.
Impact is a good way of putting that.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. That's what that performing for a group of people who are strangers is about, as opposed to performing in your family. That you are interested in having an impact on that. Those people that you're doing whatever you're doing for. Okay, so your childhood and your adolescence, you're surrounded more or less by these people, and there's a tremendous amount of music, and I'm assuming you study because you say everybody plays instruments, but did you study or you just
picked
it up?
I did take piano when I was in junior high. And I was a piano secondary in college, my first year of college.
Well, wait a second. So, junior... Oh, go ahead.
But what I was going to say was I was sick a lot as a kid. And so my father bought me what is called a tenor guitar. It's not to be confused with a baritone ukulele. It's a guitar with four strings because my hands were too small to play all six strings. So that's how I started learning to play the guitar, not through lessons, but just through playing with the family and by myself. Piano, all of my mother's siblings play the piano, so I had a lot of lessons in that way growing up. I took real lessons in junior high school.
So you learned theory.
I was not very good at it, but I tried to learn theory.
I remember it myself.
It was like way too mathematical for me.
Okay, so take me to that moment in junior high when it occurred to you that perhaps this was something you would like to do with your life or something that turned you on or something that...
You know, I think traveling around so much, being in so thrown into new situations so often, there was something about being able to get up on a stage, and this was for a production of The Wizard of Oz, and I played the Cowardly Lion. There was something about the laughter that I heard, that because of what I was doing, that was so enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Knowing that at that moment I was making people laugh.
Yeah. You were having an impact.
I don't even know if I knew.
But
that's
I don't
what
think you I don't think you needed to know that consciously, but that they were affected by you.
And I also think that because we were all laughing at the same thing, we were all part of the same experience. So we were not separate at that moment. We weren't unknowns to each other. We were experiencing that moment together, which made us one.
Yeah, it's a very powerful experience.
It is.
And it's interesting because, so I hear this kind of dichotomy. It's probably that I don't hear it right. So you could correct me. On the one hand, we have this boy who is immersed in a group, right? Part of an extended group to which he clearly belongs. And on the other hand, we have this boy who's a singleton in his family and is traveling around all over the place, so is not really, is that correct?
That's exactly right.
Right.
Exactly right.
Right. So the stage experience gave you a little bit of the I am a part of something larger than myself, or that's not right?
I think what it did was it for that moment, for those moments, it created the family.
Yes, yes.
It created the unit.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think it also gave me a sense of, I'm going to say power. I don't think power is the right, but it was the ability to impact a group of people.
Oh, yeah.
That is just, you know it's right. You feel this moment that it's right, which again is what theater is all about. It's about that moment, that individual moment that will never happen again, has never happened before, will never happen again. And that's why that impact that you have with that group of people is because you know you have shared a unique experience. I don't think I knew that. That's not how I put it.
No, I'm quite sure that's right. But I think you're right. I also think that it's an interesting combination of things. It's I am a part of this, and yet I am an individual who's having an impact. It's both of them at the same time. Pretty heady stuff, right? Pretty seductive. Also, there's, I think, from the way you're describing it, I don't know that everyone feels this, that there is a sense of intimacy that's pretty powerful.
Hmm? Oh, the sense of the intimacy is extremely powerful. I had an acting teacher who at one point said, our job is to show humanity on stage because so many out there are unable to feel it in their day-to-day life. I believed it that because I grew up with so much love in my family, it was very easy for me to be emotionally open in that way. And yet, because I was a loner, because I was an only child, and you know, you're removing the kid from the family, the big family unit, and going halfway across the country, that being on stage gave me the outlet, as you said before, to kind of reconnect with
right.
a unit. Now, there's the other part about that we're talking about real heady stuff, but the fact of the matter is I got to be on stage at that point in a lion costume and play. I was playing. How bad can that be?
Right.
It was play.
Right. It's all of it. Right. Mm-hmm. It's all of it. And I want to say again that I really think I saw that in you on stage. That I really did feel connected to you on stage. In fact, it was very powerful, I thought. So I think you're actually doing it.
Good. Thank you. it's difficult in a theater like this. It's difficult in a Broadway house, which is 1,500 to 2,000
right.
people. It's real easy in the cabaret.
Yes, because you can see everybody
you
in their
close-up.
You see
every single person.
Right.
They may not know it, but you,
yes, right,
but
right.
you can
you see
it.
Them. Right.
It's that journey that we're all going to take that night.
Yes.
Some people aren't going to like it. Some
right.
people are going to love it.
Right.
Some people are
going to
sit in the middle and go, eh.
Right.
But we're all going to take the same journey.
The journey, right. I think you are doing what you said you had meaning for you, that you are, in fact, connecting to the audience, and that's very powerful. It's very, so I'm not surprised you work as much as you do, because it's great. And in addition to that, you do all these other things. You play the guitar, and you sing great, and you dance, and you choreograph. I mean, okay, so we have you as a lion.
As a lion, right.
I don't suppose you were born in the sign of the lion.
No, I'm an Aquarian.
Really? It's interesting.
The great communicators
exactly.
of the zodiac.
Exactly, right. Perfect. So we have you here, and you have this experience, and it stands out, obviously, because you remember it. And so do you have a conscious thought, whew, I like, well, let me ask it differently. What made you audition? Because up until now, singing, playing, music, I didn't hear acting. So what made you, this is a straight play.
I really don't know.
Huh?
Except I was in a junior high school, and I was already connected with the arts group of the high school, mm-hmm. of the junior high. And everybody was doing that.
Yeah. So you just did. Right. Okay.
I went along with the crowd.
Exactly. And again, you were sort of a part of a group, weren't
mm-hmm.
you? And you did what the group did, which is what your experience had been, right? Were you surprised to be cast?
I wasn't originally cast as the lion.
Ooh.
I was originally cast as, I think, the mayor of Munchkin City or something like that.
Yes.
And my best friend, his name was Kermit Saunders, was cast as the lion. And he grabbed me and took me to the teacher. And he said, I don't think I should be playing. I think he should be playing that.
Did he say why?
I don't remember.
Do you remember being surprised or curious or delighted or mad?
I was delighted.
You were?
Yes, I was delighted. It's funny. I don't dwell a lot on those kinds of memories, that I remember that this is what happened, this is how it happened, and that it was a good experience, that it was a good memory. But as far as the details are concerned, I have a visual of us standing in the open door of the teacher's classroom.
Yeah.
that's kind of
But what that means to me is that that was really significant.
It was.
For you to have that image, that... I mean, my God, thousands and millions and billions of things happen to us and we don't have images of it.
Right.
Right.
You don't have that visual, that mental
That's right.
picture
exactly.
of it.
Exactly. Right. So that must have been very significant.
It was.
Right. And, yeah, go
oh,
ahead.
I was going to say, there's another aspect of this mm-hmm. that I think it shouldn't be overlooked. So I played this part in a junior high school piece, was successful, and I got a lot of attention.
Mm, yeah, I was going to ask about that. Right.
So I think that also goes back to only child, that attention, that,
right,
that
right.
getting that.
That feels right.
It feels right.
Yes, it does.
And I knew I must have been doing something right.
Yes, yes. So, okay. So then do you remember that you thought maybe I could do this or you didn't do that at all?
Not at that point, no.
No, okay. So do you remember where the next moment is?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. The next moment happens when I am a junior in high school, and this is in Louisville, Kentucky. And we're doing Camelot. And I was cast as King Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a junior, and I'm cast in the lead. This is not... done or was not done in high school. Seniors got the lead. That was the way it worked.
Right.
And there was something about that character that I really connected with as well. I think it was the idealism, the humanity of him trying to make the world a better place for everyone.
He's such a good guy.
Oh, he's a great guy, and he's a believer in the goodness of the human soul, above the even forgiving his wife and his best friend for betraying him.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a wonderful character. My dad doesn't remember this. I remember this. He said, I think he probably came to every single performance, he and my mother. He said, I think this is what you should be doing. He doesn't remember that.
Wow.
But I sure do.
No kidding.
That's a powerful moment, to have that kind of support from your father.
Yes.
And I don't know if it's that powerful, say, with the relationship between a daughter and a mother, but that relation, that acceptance and that support for a son from his dad is pretty significant. I laugh because I don't think he doesn't remember, or he chooses not to remember.
Well, because
there's a little too much emotion involved.
Oh, I see. He's a scientist or something.
He's a scientist,
right, and you don't want to go there. I was thinking something else. I was thinking, then you did it, and he's not sure he wants to take responsibility for the fact you did this.
No, I was really blessed in that I had the support of my family.
Yeah.
And have had the support of my family.
Well, and that's pretty interesting, because from someone whose life is very different, to be able to see that in you and not do what so many parents do, which is, oh no, you have to be like me, or you have to live the life that I think is right, or whatever that is. Your father didn't do that. Kudos to him.
Kudos to that entire extended family. Now, I know that they may have been sitting there going, thinking, what is he going to do? How is it? But they were supportive of it. And that I find to be really interesting. I find that to be very far ahead of their
time. It's extraordinary. It really is.
I mean, this would have been in, you know, the early 70s.
Well, and the other thing that's interesting to me about this is that you're the only child. If there are a bunch of them and they lose one to the arts, okay, fine. You know what I mean?
But one starving artist is
enough,
okay.
Right, okay. But to have all of your hopes and dreams on the one, and to allow that one to take the risk of being in the arts, that's a big deal. Because it is a risk. Everybody knows it's a risk.
It was a risk to them. It never seemed to be a risk to me. It seemed to be the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I knew even then when I was on stage, I knew that this was where I felt at home, where I was comfortable, and living that heightened reality for those 2 hours a night, or with Camelot, 2.5. and also, my mother has always been extremely supportive as well, in a very different way. And my mom's background is in literature and history. On one hand, I had my dad, the scientist, and I had my mother, who was a teacher of history and literature, and then went into library sciences.
Uh-huh.
So I had there was a nice balance there.
Yeah. And everybody played music.
And everybody sang and played music, yeah. It was interesting. And I grew up in the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
So I'm a child of the 60s. college campuses of the 60s.
Oh, my God. Right.
You know, that's a pretty...
Yes.
Mind-blowing experience. and I think there's... Because of that, there was a lot of freedom given to me to explore.
Yeah. Okay, so we have you in junior high. High school. And essentially, the die is cast.
I'm afraid so, yes.
Yes. So now it's time to think about colleges, and what did you do?
Since my parents were on the faculty of the University of Louisville, I went to the University of Louisville School of Music as a voice major.
Hmm.
Now, they did not want me to be, not my parents, but the faculty did not want me to be a voice major. They thought I was better suited for education.
On what did they base that?
It was a classical music school.
Oh, I see.
And I do not have a classical voice.
No, you don't. And so, whoa, how odd. So they thought you should teach.
They thought I should teach.
God.
Well, that's, again, we're talking about a period of time where the powers that be felt that it was important to guide you into where you were best suited.
Well, what's so interesting to me is that not
this
your parents.
This is a freedom school.
Right? The school? That's so odd.
It is very strange.
Yes. So did you persevere, or they got
you? Well, what happened was, and I don't even know how this happened, Lynn. I have no idea. I got wind of a school. Now, when I was going and looking for colleges, we also looked at Indiana University, which at that point did not have a musical theater degree. You had to do a double major. Eastern Kentucky University had a musical theater degree. I did not want to be in Eastern Kentucky when I was looking probably just towards bigger things. Mm-hmm. I got wind of a school in Cincinnati called the College Conservatory of Music, better known as CCM. Great, great people have come out of CCM, and I was in a wonderful class. I, on my own, with a friend from college who drove me up, I did out all the admission papers and everything on my own. He drove me up there. My parents knew, drove me up there to audition. I did a terrible audition, singing Soliloquy from Carousel, and did singing to My Little Girl very pompously. And I remember the professors going, whoa. But what they did was they then directed me, and I was able to make this switch, this complete opposite switch.
So they could see that you could.
They saw that I...
You had it.
I had was open, yeah, at least to being able to explore different things. I was accepted, and then went to the University of Cincinnati for 2 years before I quit.
Ooh.
I don't know where this. How I just knew that this was what I was supposed to be doing. This was the path I was supposed to be taking. There was never any question about it. So I am in. At the University of Cincinnati with an incredibly talented group of people studying musical theater in a cocoon, because the conservatory is its own building, opera, dance, stagecraft, and musical theater all together, piano, all of the arts were all in this one building. I am immersed in, I really started dancing at that point, with it like in class, learning about stagecraft and design and what happens back, what really happens backstage, focused on performance of musical theater, which is odd because that was not really my focus from the outset, was legit theater, straight theater, which is where I really, my heart is strongest. So here I am with this incredibly talented group of people. New Yorkers will know 2/3 of them. Some are television personalities now. I was working also a lot outside of school. But I think this came from that again, period of time where we are going to tear you down so that we can build you up from scratch. So I never seemed to be able to do it right in school. And yet outside of school, in the real world, so to speak, people were grabbing to have me come and work with them. After my second year, my junior year, I woke up one morning and said, I'm going to move to New York. And I'd never been to New York. Cincinnati was the biggest city I had ever been in. I'm going to move to New York. And so at the end of that summer, I was working at Kings Island at that point. I up and moved to New York. Out of the blue. Moved in with some friends.
Wow. And your family said, okay.
Yeah. They did. I quit school.
Yeah.
And they supported me.
This must have been quite something for them, both dedicated as much as they were to education and finishing it.
And working in academia.
Right, exactly. Right. Okay, so you moved to New York. Apparently you survived.
I did survive. That first year was rough, but I did survive. I worked at Macy's, and I worked for Citibank. Got a call from the choreographer that I had worked at Kings Island the year before that. She said, please come help me restage the show in Richmond, and we'll put you in Richmond until for preseason weekends, and then we'll move you down to Charlotte, and you'll do the summer in Charlotte. So I did that. I came back to New York, immediately started auditioning again, and got my equity card, playing Robin, as in Robin the Boy Wonder, as in Batman and Robin, in an arena show called Bugs Bunny in Space.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I did that. I was on the road with that. I started to develop shin splints.
Oy.
Well, the costumes were really, really heavy. I not only played Robin,
well,
but I also played Wile E. Coyote right. on roller skates and what we called a Q-Pig, which was a Cupid but a pig for the Porky and Petunia duet.
I see.
So yeah. Heavy costumes, and I started to develop shin splints. And I left the tour, went back to New York. Another friend from the tour who had also left called me up and said another friend of ours who was on the tour had injured himself in an audition, and they needed somebody else for the show they were doing at the York Theater. Now, I don't really know what the York Theater is at this point, nor did I really know the importance of the piece that we were doing, but it was the revival of the first New York revival of Stephen Sondheim's Anyone Can Whistle.
Oh, my.
And she gave me the director's number. I called the director, went in and auditioned, and was cast in the show.
Wow.
So it's my first New York show. I'm working with a very well-known off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway theater company called the York Theater Company. Mm-hmm. I have the opportunity to work with up-and-coming directors, scenic designers, music directors, Stephen Sondheim, and Arthur Lawrence.
Oh, my God. Really? Right.
So when I look back on it now, I think, no, I followed the path that I was supposed to follow. Now, just to furthermore this whole thing, so I do that. Then the next thing that happened is while I'm there, I audition. I spend the summer working at Radio City Music Hall in New York City. From there, I am called by someone that I work with there to come and replace somebody in a new piece, a new musical version of Great Expectations. I go audition in somebody's apartment. I get this part. I go in and I do that. They call me. The lead's girlfriend, wife, they weren't really married, it's theatrical, and the music director are now going to do a cruise ship, and would you come on in and sing for this guy? I go in and I sing for him. I get 3 months on the cruise ship. The company that I worked with before wants me to come and choreograph with them for the summer. I go there. I go back to New York. I audition immediately. I run into a friend. I'm going to one audition. He says, come stand in line with me. We used to do that in those days. Come stand in line. Guys, just stand in line with me. And since I'm in line, I might as well go on and stand in line. And I'm going to go on and sing. I've got my music and everything. And I walk in and I sing for a little off-Broadway show called Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Oh, my God.
And am cast. Mm-hmm. God bless my friend. He's not. But I am. So now, within 3 years of being in New York, I worked with Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence, Tim Rice, and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
So I guess the message there is that you followed your bliss and
I followed
you
my
were
bliss
right.
And I was right.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. And I was young enough and I think naive enough.
Right. Not to just think this was how it was.
Right.
Right.
And to know that this is what I'm feeling, this is what I should do. Do it.
Right.
No questions about it. Right. Just do it.
Right.
And that's
it's perfect. It's perfect.
And it's an amazing experience. It took me a long time to be able to place all of the timeline and to see it.
Right, to get the perspective of what it actually was. Right. And so did you go on living in New York?
Yes, I still live in New York. Mm-hmm. I'm not as naive as I was then. But I have worked with, other than a period of time that I took away just to try other things. I was in my late 20s. And I just felt like I had never done anything else. And you know, in the theater, your type changes. I don't type myself. I don't believe in that. I know a lot of people say they need to know who they are, what type you are, what your brand is, and things like that. I figure there are plenty of people who'll do that for me. I don't need to do that. But the age is,
yes,
that's what happens. Yes. You grow into different parts.
Right.
In my late 20s.
And out of different parts.
And out of parts. And there's nothing wrong with that, because physically the things you could do then, you don't want to do anymore. Just hurts too much. And that sneaks up on you too.
Yeah,
boy.
It does. So
I did go and I taught myself to touch type. And I worked briefly for lawyers.
Hmm.
Which was a really interesting experience. I was like a floater, a temp. I would come in and I would like do night work. So, mm-hmm. Because I found that the skills that I had that had made me successful within the theater weren't limited to the theater.
No, they'll work anywhere.
They will work anywhere. Personality, common sense, creativity,
flexibility
works in every field.
Yeah.
But if your heart's not there,
no.
Then yes, you can do this. But are you happy? Mm-hmm. This was a wonderful period of time of just trying to figure out what's going to make me happy.
Right.
Life is short. Yeah. Even in your late 20s, you kind of go, whoa, life is... Where did that last 30 years go? You know, and I started to realize that happiness was the most important thing. And you could be unhappy with a lot of money coming in, or you could be happy poor. Well, I don't mean poor.
No, I understand.
That we will live within the money that we have coming in is what we're going to live on.
Right. And you can either do that happy or not.
And I was exhausted working at law firms.
Wow.
You worked Monday through Friday, and all I cared about was that weekend. I wanted the weekend. And I also was working with all of these other people who didn't have a passion for what they were doing.
Right.
Not the attorneys.
No, I understand.
But those support staff, there was no passion.
And there was also no camaraderie. There was none of what you get. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's not right.
Well, there is camaraderie, but it's a different kind of camaraderie.
But it isn't the sense that you're all in it together that you have on the stage or that you have in
no,
theater. Right?
No, right? It's not. It's a corporation.
Right.
They'll say it's a firm, but it's a corporation.
So
you got the heads and they get all the money.
Right. How long did you do it?
I didn't stop working in the theater. I stopped pursuing work in the theater.
Ah.
Now, the difference is that, this was another little light bulb moment, was people pursued me.
Right.
So while I was doing this, I was still off directing a show or choreographing a show.
Well, no wonder you were exhausted.
That's true. Well, I would leave.
Yeah. Oh,
at one point, I was actually doing an off-Broadway show at the same time I was working at the law firm. That was exhausting. I also worked with a group of people. They had a theatrical department, so they kind of understood the field. And I could go away for 3 months and work.
Right.
And come back. And it was a temp position. Mm-hmm. And come back, and the temp position was available.
Still there, right.
And I did that working more in theater than at the law firm. Working a lot at the law firm early on,
right.
Kind of like learning what it was about. And then I would say in 90, mm-hmm. 1990 or so, which would have been for me, I don't know how old I was in 1990. I can't do the math that quick. But I'd say in my 30-ish, 30-ish, started letting all of these other opportunities, and going out and pursuing the opportunities again. Mm-hmm. During that period of time, I had also grown into a very different type as far as an actor is concerned. I was no longer the young character guy.
Right, right.
I wasn't the older character guy, but I've never been a leading man. That's not my type. Mm-hmm. But the parts were changing. They were very different. And musical theater was changing.
I was just going to say.
Theater was changing.
Yes, definitely.
And we're talking about the advent of things like Les Miserables and mm-hmm. Phantom of the Opera. And, you know, I came in at the tail end of the season that Joseph moved to Broadway was the season of Dreamgirls mm-hmm. and Nine.
Right.
And Pump Boys and Dinettes. And Joseph was, and we were all of these shows are up for Best Musical.
Right.
Cats came in the next season, and then Phantom of the Opera, and then Miss Saigon, and mm-hmm. and the invasion, the musical, the
right.
British invasion, which was a great experience for Broadway. Big cast.
Right.
They kept a lot of people employed.
Working. Right.
But a very different style of theater. Now, also remember that legit theater is not really the right term. Straight plays. Angels in America.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So now we have, you know, we have Tony Kushner and Richard Greenberg is writing, and a very different style. Tom Stoppard is really coming into right. a major rediscovery in right. many ways. David Mamet.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a different style of theater there.
Right.
Big change. At the same time, AIDS.
Yes, that's right.
So my journey back into full-time theater was hindered by the physical type that I was, the vocal type that I was, what I was interested in doing, and that the people who knew me from four years before
right.
were now dead.
Oh, God, right.
So it was reintroducing myself to a whole new group of people.
My goodness, what a challenge.
It is. It's a challenge when I look back at it now.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
then it was just like, this is what you do. You just put one foot in front of the other.
Because this is what I need to do.
This is
because
what I am driven to do.
This is what I am driven
my heart
is. To do.
And that ultimately led me back to, well, I did several really wonderful off-Broadway pieces. And it led me eventually back to the Scarlet Pimpernel on Broadway. Which was another interesting experience.
Frank?
Frank Wildhorn, yeah. I adore him. Yeah. It's a great guy. What happened was I walked in, and it's this is another wonderful kind of experience that I finally am putting this all together. The casting director, who ended up working with Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat some 20 years before, and I was the dance captain on the Broadway production. So we knew each other very well. He and I became reacquainted. He was casting Scarlet Pimpernel. And so they called me in. And I came in. And I knew right away, I knew that I had given one heck of an audition. I just knew it. I knew that it was there. But what I knew was strongest for me was not the vocal part, but was the acting. Mm-hmm. And I was going in to be what they call a vacation swing, which means after 6 months, people can start going on vacations, and people were going to start going on vacations, and you were there learning that track specifically so that if anything should happen and the other swings, the regular swings, can't cover it,
you will.
You will go on. Well, I'm not even completely rehearsed. And I go on. I'm told that I'm going to have to go on.
Right.
Now, this character that I'm going on for, I would have been in my 40s at that point. Maybe I was a little, he was, let's say he was significantly older than I was. Bigger than I was. He was like a big gold English bulldog, and I'm out there like Noel Coward.
Right, exactly.
What ended up happening was they kept me.
Wow.
And we had one swing who covered the older characters, half of the men, one swing who covered the younger characters, and me who covered all of them.
Wow.
So I covered, in version one, 20 different tracks.
Oh my goodness.
And in version two, 21.
My goodness.
Again, working with some extraordinary performers. Mm-hmm. It was the tour of that I ended up back in Cincinnati for 2 weeks, that I was able to put all of this together and go, wow, this is the path you should have always been on. The one I took was it was like I went into the water and I went with the flow.
Yes.
Doesn't mean that everything works out beautifully.
No, I understand. I understand perfectly. The key to a comfortable, happy, congruent life is to do just what you're talking about. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be easy or that it's going to be successful or it's going to be any of that, but it's going to be the one that works for you, that you are the most comfortable in, the most satisfied in. And very few people are actually, I think, even aware of what that is, much less able to follow it.
When you're on the right path, the opportunities present themselves. You do not have to go searching for them. They're there. So they become choices. When you are fighting that path, you're out there trying to find those opportunities.
Right.
You're actively searching for them. But the right path, they present themselves.
You know what?
What?
I want to stop there.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
Oh.
This was really
nice. I can talk. I'm from the South.
Yes, you can.
Yeah, I sure do.
Well, yes, he definitely can talk, but not just because he's from the South. It's because he has quite a lot to say. And, of course, for me, since he's making my point, it's a powerfully important thing to say, that there is a thing that fits you. There is a life you were meant to live, and you can find it. And when you listen to Stephen, of course, you can hear that he was always looking for it. Even when he took a detour, he was always looking for what felt right for him. Now, I have precious little time left in this show, so I'm going to give you my website, which is thelinshow.com. THELYNNE, don't leave the E out of Lynn, SHOW, thelinshow.com, where you can find this interview, all the interviews that I have ever done, my book, you could buy my book, or the workbook, or the audiobook. You could find out about psychotherapy on the telephone, and you can contact me, and you can contact Josh Hackney, who, as I say every week, is the reason that this show is on the air. Every electronic recording, I like to say everything with a plug that I need to use, Josh knows how to use, fix, find, whatever. And so if you need that, thelinshow.com for both me and Josh. And as always, I hope you got something from this show, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't. I am going with a bang. Life's a song. goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go.